Hi there, this is Tim Lightfoot from the Huffines Institute. I want to take just a minute before we get to the podcast to tell you about a really cool event that we're having here. On March the 23rd, 2012, we're having Huffines Discussion 2012, and what we're calling HD2. If you remember from last year, if you've been with us that long, we had the Huffines Discussion 1 last year where we brought in 8 scholars in sports medicine, people that had big visions and big thinkers in sports medicine, and we gave them 18 minutes to tell us their big ideas and what they thought was coming. It was a great interaction that day. These talks are all at the lay level, so anyone can understand them and be with it. And so today, we're inviting you to come on March the 23rd to the Huffines Discussion 2012, 1 to 4 p.m. If you want more details, you can go to huffinesinstitute.org. Check us out. Check out the speakers we've lined up. They are just an incredible set of speakers, and you wouldn't want to miss that. In the meantime, here's the podcast.
Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello, and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute of Sports Medicine and Human Performance. We are so glad that you took the time to download us and are listening. Every week we bring you leaders in the field of sports medicine, and today we're quite pleased to have one of the longtime leaders in sports medicine, Dr. Ed Halley, who is Professor Emeritus at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Halley. Dr. Halley got his PhD originally from the University of Wisconsin. He's written several books, many textbooks, including one of the standard textbooks that's used in universities across the country in exercise physiology. I believe it's in the 8th edition. He has been the president of the American College of Sports Medicine. He's been the chair of the Scientific Advisory Board for the President's Council on Physical Fitness and Sports, along with numerous other honors and titles that he has had over the years, hundreds of publications. And one of the best things about Dr. Halley is he's one of the wisest and nicest people that I know in the business of sports science. So welcome to the podcast today, Ed.
Thanks a lot, Tim. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. We're going to talk, given your longevity in the business today, we're going to talk a little bit about kind of the history and how sports medicine has changed, how you've seen it change over the last 40 years. And let's just start with that. How has sports medicine or physical education or whatever you want to call it changed over the last 40 years?
Well, it's changed, I think, dramatically on campuses, but also on in terms of what goes on in professional organizations. Both of us came up the physical education route, and the biodynamics lab at the University of Wisconsin that Bruno Balke and Fran Nagel started was in the physical education department there. And that was a fairly typical house for exercise physiology programs to be located in. And over the years, we went from undergraduate physical education programs where that was the only major, as the number of jobs in physical education decreased and opportunities in other areas, the growth in fitness, the whole business of fitness and corporate fitness and hospital-based cardiac rehab and so forth, fitness programs began to grow. And over time, by the late 90s, physical education major at UT essentially faded out because we just did not have more students, any students choosing the major. And that was not atypical in many schools. The opportunities for students to go into physical therapy and so on really moved us in the direction of the an undergraduate exercise science type track, and programs, of course, changed their names from physical education, exercise science, now most of them are kinesiology, yeah, I think, to reflect all that change.
Yeah, you made a couple of, I think, really interesting points here, and that is that this field has really, in particular, has changed over the last several years to prepare students more for graduate health care options such as physical therapy and occupational therapy. And very much more science-based than we would normally think of the traditional physical education.
Yeah, and I think that on our campus, again, I don't think it's different than most of the same type of large state universities, the students in the past would have chosen, for example, biology and to move towards physical therapy or occupational therapy and the like. And I think over the last 15 years, the realization was that a student coming through our program, they wind up with the same chemistry, physics, calculus, and so on. And with the number of elective hours, they can choose classwork to get them to PT school or med school or whatever. And it created alternative outcomes. So if they did not get into their first choice career, it wasn't a dead end. And in many cases, with some of the other undergraduate degrees, the opportunities were not as clear. So, I think it's a very different shop. The vast majority, I'd say 80-plus percent of the undergraduates choose physical therapy as a career, which is tough right now because it's so difficult to get in.
Yeah. I guess the flip side of this is, though, you're talking about the physical education majors have gone away. Who's teaching PE now in the schools?
There's still some schools turning out physical education majors. Right. I think what happened is that the large state universities where they had a large research mission, it just gradually vanished.
Mm. Yeah. Is that reflective of a lack of jobs in physical education?
Well, it certainly was that for us around the Knoxville, East Tennessee area back in the late 80s and early 90s, that the number of positions was shrinking. And, of course, it was the prelude for the obesity epidemic. You would think that with that going on, we'd have had this increased need of more physical education instructors. But that certainly has not been the case. I think we're going to see a pendulum swing back in that direction.
Yeah.
There's the SPARK program from the group in San Diego has now been adopted by a variety of programs to systematically increase the amount of moderate and vigorous intensity physical activities kids get during the day. And it's not just during physical education. They try to do things before school and actually incorporate physical activity in classroom activities during the day in terms of trying to get that side of the energy balance equation shifted.
Well, you and I were at a meeting recently, and we were chatting about this topic, and you made, I think, an excellent point, and that is that if the physical inactivity problem that we have now had been in any other field, there would have been national hue and cry to develop more PE educators or more educators to go out and teach. But now, instead of that happening in many cases, the solution is that we're asking other people to pick up the PE teacher job in many cases.
Yeah, I think that's true. You think about over the last 20, it's actually more than that, 20 or 30 years, we can go all the way back, I guess, to Sputnik, where when the Sputnik went up before our first satellite went up, the feeling was that the quality of math and science in the country was low and we needed to invest more. And so that was more time for math and science, more teachers in math and science, and so on. That continues to this day. Because of scores on national exams or comparison with children in other countries.
We have the STEM programs, as a matter of fact. It's a lot of emphasis on that.
Right, yeah. And so that's still going on. And we really have not seen that, despite the fact that there's clearly a major problem with childhood obesity and some of the comorbidities that go along with it. And, again, I think that there's going to be a pendulum swing. I think we're going to see more systematic program to address those concerns.
Yeah. I guess this leads to another, topic, and that is we know more and more about how activity in particular is part of a healthy behavior or part of a healthy individual. Why has our population gotten obese and less active as opposed to more active? It seems like we know more about it and the positive benefits, but yet we don't do it.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think a different answer depending on what area of science that you want to deal with. On the nutrition side, I think you'll hear arguments made about access to highly palatable, high-fat, and very inexpensive food compared to, say, 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And people don't want to think about food being cheap, but it is relative to what we had to pay as a percent of salary way back when. So you have that on the one side. And on the other side, we have systematically reduced the need for physical activity in the things that we do, be it the work we do around the house or work we do at work. And I use as the example, you don't have to think back, I don't have to think back too far about if I wanted to go to the library and get references for a particular paper, I'd be in the stacks on this floor carrying the books down to a Xerox machine in another floor and putting coins in order to generate the copy. And right now, of course, I can sit at home, turn on my computer, and download a PDF while sipping a cool beer.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there is, and that's not, that's just an isolated one, but everything from driving everywhere, subdivisions popping up so that physical activity was essentially designed out of what kids and adults would do. So we've created circumstances where we've reduced the need for physical activity on the one hand and made the access to food easier on the other.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's things going on in all corners to deal with that. So hopefully we'll see some progress made.
What can we do? I mean, what is, again, having been in the field for a while and been and served on so many important boards, what can we do? What steps can we each take or as a society take and health policy to maybe make some changes in this area?
Well, the CDC has taken a lead on that in terms of identifying places where various groups or segments can plug in. So in a community, it could be more hike, bike trails, safe sidewalks to walk on. In the schools, enhanced physical activity, enhanced opportunities to be physically active, not during just structured physical education classes.
Right.
Prior to school, following school, the access to facilities in the evening by members of the community. In terms of government initiatives, more support being given to provide, frankly, the infrastructure for bike trails and walking trails. And, for example, individuals in the public health sector whose primary mission might be the physical activity side.
Mm-hmm.
You look on business, and business leaders have really stepped up over the years where you have corporate wellness programs, and they can show quantitatively that they truly get bang for the buck. In terms of the dollars they invest, they get more dollars back in terms of everything from productivity, lost time, and so on. So there's segments from government where policy changes, you know, the most recent thing is taking certain soda machines out of schools. I don't know if that's going on down in Texas.
As long as you don't mess with our Dr. Pepper down here.
There you go.
You can take anything else out, but leave our Dr. Pepper alone.
And changing the lunch menus, which requires, that's the involvement of people up the line to make those decisions that are ultimately translated into the school environment. And so I think that there's a lot of things going on right now, and it cuts across both policymakers and government on one end to the opportunity to be physically active with safe exercise areas and access to, be it parks, bike trails, and whatever. And there's more of that going on. Some communities have really figured it out better than others. And, in fact, it's always a real welcome sight when you go to a community and just see people biking, walking everywhere. And it's because
easily
access the trails and safely do it. They don't have to drive a car 15 miles to get to it.
Well, it's interesting that you started off talking about how the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, are the ones that are taking the lead in this. And usually we think of the CDC as being associated with things like malaria or HIV. I mean, that really shows a shift, I think, in our thinking about what is killing Americans, doesn't it? I mean, we're now really talking more about non-communicable diseases versus communicable diseases.
CDC is the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and so it's the prevention aspect that's left out of with the initial, but in terms of their education programs, be it for vaccination or increased physical activity, they've certainly been a major player. You think back not too many years, in 1995, when they came out with the American College of Sports Medicine with their public health physical activity guideline of doing 30 minutes of moderate intensity physical activity most days of the week. And that was a transformation in terms of the way physical activity was recommended. Mm-hmm. At point, as you and I know, is that the emphasis was on vigorous physical activity done 3 or 4 days a week, using the target heart rate and all the rest of it. And due to research that was clearly coming forward in the 1980s, that there was clear evidence that the volume of physical activity was one of the most important variables, and it could be obtained, that volume, by doing a wide variety of different intensities, including moderate intensity physical activity. And so when that statement came out, that was just a very important step, because it told people that you can do a brisk walk 5 days a week and gain health benefits, and that's been substantiated since that paper came out.
Yeah. Since you mentioned this, and that's one of the things I think people get confused about, and they go, well, geez, if I only have to go out and work out moderately, why do I even want to go out and think about running? But if someone were to work out at a higher intensity, that gives them different benefits, doesn't it?
Well, I look on as additional, perhaps. The most recent position stand that came out of Washington, the first United States physical activity guideline in 2008, they made it very clear, as did the updated ACSM position stand, that one can achieve the volume of physical activity with either moderate or vigorous, with roughly a 2-to-1 ratio, meaning if you're going to do moderate activity, you need to do it about twice as long compared to vigorous activity. Mm. So those who do vigorous activity only have to exercise half as long to achieve the same caloric expenditure or volume of activity that is associated with significant reduction in health risk. And so a person can get more bang for the buck in the sense that if you are capable and interested in doing vigorous physical activity, you can achieve the health-related goal in a shorter period of time. And for those variables that fit the character that the more is better, that is, you have a larger reduction in risk, you actually have an increased chance of achieving that in the same time frame as an individual who would just be doing moderate physical activity. So, and there's some other variables. If anybody is interested in being physically active in sports, obviously doing some kind of systematic vigorous activity in a structured way as a prelude to that or as a part of that is a reasonable thing to do, to just condition the bones and muscles, cardiovascular system to the intensities that would be experienced in a sport in which intensity is just by definition regular as could be.
Yeah. If you go out and jump into it, the more likely you are to get injured. And
well, then you won't you know, there was a there's an excellent chapter in the physical activity guidelines, and frankly, I'd recommend to the listeners that if you're interested in more detail, the advisory committee report for the physical activity guidelines that was published the same year has a lot of detail dealing with all aspects of the science related to these health outcomes, and one of the chapters dealt with adverse outcomes. And yeah, individuals who make a large change in physical activity clearly are at increased risk, and compared to those who approach it in a very systematic, gradual, and progressive manner. And so the recommendation that you'll read in the U.S. 2008 U.S. Physical Activity Guidelines is a real emphasis on progression, whether you're working with young, overweight children or with older individuals. It is better to do too little than too much at the beginning of a physical activity program. And the evidence laid out in that chapter on adverse outcomes validates that old recommendation that we kind of grew up with in the old physical education days.
Yeah. So take it easy so you can maintain, I guess.
Gradually work into it until you can do whatever you want to do in a systematic manner. And I think I tell folks most of the time is that if you're enjoying what you're doing and it's a brisk walk, there's no need to move up to vigorous intensity unless you really want to do it.
Right.
You're going to gain the health benefits with a moderate intensity physical activity, And if it fits your schedule, it's easy to do. It certainly has a lower risk associated with it from a number of different standpoints, depending on the activity you do. For example, running outside versus walking comfortably in a mall. And so there's lots of advantages to just staying active at a moderate intensity level if it works for you.
Yeah. Now, the physical activity guidelines that you were speaking of for the audience, that's the as you said, the National Physical Activity Guidelines is very similar to the guidelines we think of with the food pyramid and so forth, but for physical activity. And we'll put links to that, to those websites, in the show notes if people want to pull those up and look at that, because there is a tremendous amount of information that's associated with those physical activity guidelines.
Yeah, and I think that the nice thing about getting onto the website for the U.S. Physical Activity Guidelines is they have nice 1- and 2-page printouts mm-hmm. that summarize them. Mm-hmm. Or if you want to, you can print out the short booklet, which provides detail for children, adults, older adults, individuals with disabilities, and so forth. And so it really, for professional listeners to the program, if you don't have that, that would be a good thing to just have on a shelf, because it would provide a ready reference across all of those populations. And it was based on a very systematic review of the literature in that advisory committee document.
And so there's really no reason people should remain uneducated about the benefits of activity.
No, Tim, I think that there's a lot of education going on out there.
Yeah.
But, you know, what you attend to, you attend to.
Right.
You know, and it's just like, you know, as people who continue to smoke, you know, I've not heard that. That smoking is bad. You know,
they haven't been listening.
What's the probability?
Well, we've talked about the past, and we've kind of talked about the present. What do you see in the future? What do you see coming down the pike in 10, 15 years?
Well, I think what's happened in our area over the last about 20 years is just going to continue. I think when we came up, or at least when I came up through the physical education exercise physiology program, most of the doctoral students had fairly common backgrounds. We take advanced physiology courses, biochemistry, and so on. And so we'd go to a meeting, and no matter where a student was doing their work, even if it was in a very different area, it was very easy to sit down and understand what that person was talking about and how it plugged in to the overall picture.
Yeah.
And since about the 1980s, and this was I think Charlie Kipin pointed that out, and then Ken Baldwin later, supported the proposition. We clearly have moved to a much more specialized science to deal with questions regarding exercise. And so you had, on the one hand, the growth of the individuals working in molecular biology,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, and literally is about the same time, you had a growth in a number of individuals pursuing epidemiology to look at issues related to physical activity and health. And if we go to a meeting right now, like the American College of Sports Medicine, which accommodates a broad spectrum of interests, you will see a large number of studies dealing with the basic science aspects of exercise in whatever form, addressing whatever tissue, be it muscle, bone, and so forth. And at the same time, you'll see some of the best-known epidemiologists talking about physical activity intervention programs and so on in terms of health outcomes. So I expect that to continue, because students right now, and if a master's student is looking at the possibility of a PhD program, they clearly are defining the individual they're going to work with. They're going to start right there. What is the area of interest, and then who are the individuals who are active scientists right now? And so students interested in the cell and molecular biology side of things are really going to run down a different path.
Right.
Those who are interested in the epidemiology side of things. So
it's almost the basic science and one path, and the public health is another path.
I agree, and I don't think that's going to change. It's needed in order to do systematic work in those areas. I think the interesting point that Ken Baldwin made in his presentation on the direction the programs are going to go, he felt that there also needed to be an increase emphasis on physical activity behavior.
Mm-hmm.
The person who is the cell biologist, but he also came up with a background that he's well aware of, the breadth of it. And it's something that addresses the question, I think, that you mentioned earlier. You know, why are people not doing it? You know,
right.
How come we've not been able to change the behavior of people regarding physical activity, given what we know about it? And so clearly there's a need for increased science in that area to figure out how to involve people, get them interested, and then move them along that continuum of behavior change from looking at it to formally doing it and then sustaining the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that needs more emphasis because we know that exercise works.
Right.
And so the real emphasis from a bang for the buck is how do we get people to do it systematically on a regular basis?
Yeah. Cheapest medicine out there. Now we can just get people to take it, huh?
I think I've heard that expression, exercise is medicine.
Yeah, just a bit. We're running a little short on time here, and we give all of our guests at the end of each podcast the opportunity to give a take-home message. If you want to tell the audience one thing to remember, what would that be?
I'd say be a role model. Number one, be physically active, stay active, not to show off, but demonstrate your formal commitment to being physically active for all of the benefits that we know. I think from the standpoint of those who are working around universities, and it is probably the best job in the world, the capacity to influence people who are truly going to shape the future. It is a unique job. I loved doing it when I was doing it, and I'd say to those in that environment, enjoy every minute because it goes way too fast.
Yeah, and some people would say you're still doing it, even if you're not formally at the university every day of the week.
Well, it's true. You don't stop what you're doing,
right.
But you stop that aspect of it. It's a need to bring young blood in that has a lot more excitement to throw at some issues that you can't or don't want to anymore.
Yeah. Well, Ed, thank you so much for taking the time to,
my pleasure,
to be with us today.
Okay. You're doing a terrific job with the show. Keep it up.
Thank you. And I'd like to thank all of you that are listening for taking the time to download us today. And I've been just handed a question. You know, we've got our nifty new T-shirts out, and if you're the first one to email us the correct response to this question, you'll get one of those nifty T-shirts for yourself to wear. And so our question for the day is, which federal government agency is taking the lead in working to increase physical activity in the United States? Again, be the first one to send us the answer to that question via email at huffinespodcast@tamu.edu, and you have the T-shirt. Again, thanks, Ed. Thank you all for listening, and please join us next week when we have another leader in sports medicine join us. And until then, we hope you stay active and healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Kelsey Sachs and Cheryl Myrick and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sidney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.